Carter. And does everybody know each other? I think you know everybody here, don't you?
Most of you, yes.
Okay, does everybody not know everybody? Oh, okay, introduce yourself.
So I'm Kevin Porter, I'm the Regional Vice President for the Hospital Association of Southern California, representing the Inland. Mm-hmm.
And you've been here before.
Yeah, I have been. Mm-hmm. It's been a while.
You had an associate with you, too.
My assistant, yes.
Wow, you've got a good memory.
Yes.
Wow. I'm getting there, huh?
Was I here?
Well, welcome everybody to the new season, I guess. We didn't meet in September, did we?
No, we didn't.
Okay, so this is the in-season meeting. Since the season has started, the temperature is below 100. And welcome everybody, and do I hear a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
I second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, great. Is there any public comment? Hearing none. Approval of the minutes of June 20th, which are attached. Anybody have any corrections to the minutes? Do I hear a motion to accept it?
I motion to accept.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. Okay, now we're moving on to new business, and we have two inspections to talk about, the second quarter and the third quarter, and I will turn it over to our inspector.
Hi, good morning. The re-inspection, the first item is actually for quarters one and two, where we've been following up with the hospital to see where they are or what the status is on some of the items identified earlier in the year. The you should have that report in front of you. Item 19-19, which was mezzanine room lights, was completed. And then over to the next page, one east, the stained ceiling tiles in the staff lounge were completed. The ceiling tiles in patient room 1501 were completed. And then over on three east, the door to the staff lounge that was completed and verified. There are still a few items outstanding that Steve Ballard and I have looked at and talked about. Item 19-26, which is upgrading the non-rated fire stop in a sprinkler room in the education center. In fact, he may have already done it when we met on this past Monday. He was going to go ahead and get right after that with his folks. On one east, item 19-29, they've been pretty busy on the one east unit with kind of the women infants, and so they haven't gotten in to replace that mirror yet, but that's on Steve's list.
Actually, I did it last night.
Oh, did he? Okay, good.
Yeah, he did do those two items.
And then item 1933, he was waiting for the door to arrive, and as soon as that comes in, he'll complete that.
So the wrong door arrived.
Yeah, he had, exactly. He had mentioned that the wrong door had arrived, so they had to send it back and get the correct one in. So you know, he's still in process on that. And also there was a couple of items I forgot to mention on the completed. When we went up to second floor, the hospital has been working on trying to get some additional handrail and end caps for the Sinatra Tower. They don't manufacture that type anymore. So Steve, working together with administration, has gotten some additional material, and then they're using the old material to repair some of the end caps on the other floor. So that 1908 is completed. And let's see, there was the... and the 1907 is also completed.
Could I ask a question about this document? It doesn't have a date on it. The second quarter 2019 facilities reinspection is as of what date? Not as of, it hasn't been updated, has it?
Well, each item, it has the...
No, but you just said there were some that were, you just updated verbally a few things, right?
No, I've got dates on here that I saw on 10/14, for example.
Okay, my document doesn't have that.
For instance, 1907 in the packet, it shows...
Well, look at 1919.
It has the, it doesn't have the 10/14 dates on the...
There are no 10/14 dates on the document attached to the agenda.
So we need the updated one. Do you want me to print it right quick so you have it?
The thing that came with the packet, there's nothing after 8/8/19 attached to the packet.
8/8/19?
Yeah.
You're referring to the date?
That's the last update according to this document.
Well, some of the items, for instance, oh, for instance, 1908 says October 2019 completion.
19 what?
08.
I don't have a document that has 1908 on it.
So I don't know what package you guys are looking at.
Okay. Here. That's what you sent us. Or that was what was in the, so it was online.
So yeah, there's 19, if you keep scrolling to page 7.
But it doesn't have the 10/14.
If there's nothing, no dates after, see what I mean?
No, I don't understand what you mean, no I don't. Like I see October 2019 completion date.
Show me where it says October anything there, on any of those.
Or you look into the report attached.
So 1908 says right here, October 2019 completion. Right there, on 1908. The third item, behind June.
It says in process for October 19th completion, and then the last input is 8/8/19 in process.
So he rearranged them then. They should be, the date should be.
There's just a newer version of it that has.
I think he's looking at a newer version.
Oh, I see.
On here.
Okay.
That's all. So, and so I thought.
I've sent it to print. Hopefully it'll print out here.
So I see what you're saying. There was a slight change that happened yesterday that was not sent to the committee. And it was very minor.
Okay. So.
For first quarter and second quarter, we have one item outstanding, which is the door that's on right.
Okay.
From updated for the ones I know.
Okay, so that updated attachment will be included in the minutes of this meeting.
Correct.
Got it. Because I was trying to follow this and it wasn't saying yeah. That's all. Okay, and I understand there's only one item outstanding.
Well, actually, then there's the there's the door, and then the mirror. That I haven't seen yet.
That you haven't seen.
And then the fire stop. So
okay.
Those two were done.
Yeah.
And
you can go check those.
I can give you speak today if it's available.
That's fine. I mean, it can be in the next whatever. I just, again, it wasn't syncing to what I was looking at. That's all.
Yeah, the item that when I, okay, so.
It's fine. I understand that.
We're good.
Anybody else have any questions about the inspection?
Well, then that's the re-inspection part, and then on Monday, we also did the third quarter inspection, and that was of the West Tower, which included the helipad.
Do we have a document on that?
You don't. That was not provided. I mean, they just did the inspection on Monday. He provided, we've been going back and forth with Steve and with Mike on some different details and things that one person thinks is complete, whereas another person may not. So no, that is not available.
Okay, so we're just doing a verbal report
now?
That's
correct.
Okay.
Okay, so the West Tower, which was the helipad, the mechanical penthouse below that, and then the Women Infant Center, which is on the second floor, NICU, also second floor, and radiology, and the emergency department. The main highlights there, there were two emergency lights, I call them the bug lights, where we should lose power at the hospital, those will immediately go on, and two of those failed. And so Steve is working on those. One was in the postpartum nurse's station, and the other one was in emergency department in the pulmonary lab there. The other items were some stained ceiling tiles kind of throughout. And I know Steve and Mike DeToro and Steve McCotter and I have always talked about be nice to get the staff on board to report those when they see those so that the maintenance staff can get on them. But Steve is on those right now. There was also one item that that we're not sure if it's actually a finding, and that's in the radiology IT closet. There were two sleeves that had cables running through, and we're not sure if that's actually a rated wall. Steve is working on either identifying whether or not that's an issue, or else just taking care of it.
Yeah, he's doing it.
I was really pleased to go onto the Women Infant Center, though, to see the upgrades in the 18 labor and delivery rooms. I know Carol was there too, and I don't know if Carol remembers the old head walls that they had in each of the patient rooms that were in such terrible condition, but the new head walls and upgrades to those rooms, just a wonderful addition. And kind of a want to know for me, not so much a need to know on the inspection, but we, with Steve Ballard, we went over to the S5 elevator that serves the Sinatra Tower. And now that that's in operation, I just asked him if I could take a look at it. And he showed me how wonderful that elevator is. We actually rode up and down the elevator a lot faster, but the interior is very well done. So
is that nice. The one in the back?
Kind of in the ICU corridor.
Is it?
It's the one that took like 9 months.
Does it go up and down by the nurse's station?
Correct.
Back there?
Yeah. In the Sinatra Tower.
In the Sinatra, not the east.
Yeah, in the Sinatra Tower. But it's not the patient elevator or the staff elevators that you walk into first. It's the one in the back.
It's kind of in, I don't know if to describe it any better, it's just inside the intensive care interior corridor.
Where does it go?
It goes up straight up the Sinatra Tower all the way to the fifth floor.
So on the fourth floor, where does it let out? Behind the nurses?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to
So anyway, that was very good to see that.
I know of four elevators. There's the one visitor elevator.
There are 18 elevators.
No, I'm talking about in the Sinatra Tower. In the Sinatra Tower, when you come in for visitors, there's one elevator. There used to be another one, but there's one. Okay, it's one elevator. Then, if you go around the corner, there's another elevator. That's two. Is that one and two?
No, well, there's two back to back.
Two there, back to back.
So you go into an alcove, there's one to your left, one to your right. Then if you go around...
Not on the lobby floor.
Yeah, on the lobby floor.
Yeah.
One, if you walk into that little alcove where you take the elevator up to Sinatra Tower, there's an elevator to the left, and there's an elevator right behind it to the right. Mm-hmm. There's two elevators in that little alcove.
There's a, it's a wall. I just went there today.
There's an elevator, a wall, and then an elevator in a U shape.
Okay. I'm blind. Sorry. I thought they were across from each other.
Unless you're talking.
There are two across from one another.
Two across from each other.
Okay, well, when I
in
was...
In the same alcove, though.
Yeah.
And then there's another one over in a different hallway.
Okay.
No. It's that game where you have to draw pictures based off of someone's description.
Oh, yeah. When I took the visitor elevator up to the fourth floor today, I thought... Gee, I thought there was an elevator across from it. It's just a wall.
There's actually a blank shelled-in shaft there.
Yeah, yeah.
For sometime...
But there's only one elevator.
There's only one visitor elevator. There is space to actually put another one in that was shelled in.
There's only one visitor elevator. On the floors, there's the visitor elevator, and then there's a staff elevator.
I'm totally confused. I'm quiet.
Well, okay. It's just that when you say the elevator 5 or 2, I never quite know what you're talking about. So
anyway, the one that had been down for quite some time, for all of the OSHPOD folks dealing with them, I just am reporting that I got to see that one in operation, and they did a wonderful job with that. Not only the modification of the equipment, which now makes the elevator go faster, but also the interior is very well done. So.
Thank you.
So that's all I have on the report. What we'll be doing is when we end up scheduling the fourth quarter inspection in the near future, I will also then go and reinspect the items that were on this list as well.
Is there anything left over from first quarter?
Yeah.
The doorway?
Yeah.
There oh, okay. Are, okay. So,
I don't know if that was first or second quarter, but I know we have the door item, and then you need to go see two other items that you haven't validated yet.
Correct.
Yeah. Carol, you want to answer it? You want to add anything?
The emergency department remodel is, I mean, they've really done a great job. The problem that I saw was that the bathroom, the tiled bathrooms in that area, because it's ceramic tile and they're, you know, old fashioned and, you know, what, 20 something years old, they're discolored and they just, it's such a stark, you know, it's so. You see this beautiful emergency department, and you go in the bathroom, you see this tacky floors and tacky stuff. They're all discolored and everything. And I guess the reasoning is that the tile is difficult to take out or replace. Or
yeah, there's a treatment, because like in the patient rooms, as we've been refurbishing the rooms in the East Tower, there's a treatment for some of that old product that kind of makes it alive again. I'm just trying to think in my mind where you're referring to. Are you referring to the area of the new expansion, or are you referring to an area we haven't gotten to upgrade yet as part of the remodel? I'm not.
There were three bathrooms, right. Restrooms. The men and
interior?
Women's in the off the lobby. The men and women's okay. There. The tile is
off the lobby.
Off the lobby.
Right before
the
you go
lobby
in.
By the cafeteria.
No, right before you go into the emergency room.
Okay. So that area hasn't been refurbished.
That's all being remodeled now, isn't it?
Well, heaven help me, by January of 2020, yes.
It's being worked on now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I want to make sure.
Oh, okay.
The area, so I can kind of go back and check and make sure that that's an in-scope item that's being addressed.
And
so I think I got you now. So it's right on the little lobby area, and it's the male-female restrooms off of that.
Just right before you go into the security doors.
And then there was some other areas that opened up, and the tile was.
Yeah, there's the restroom inside, the patient restroom inside of the emergency department.
So it's all the restroom.
It's the same tile issue where the tile is just worn out. I know. When we were walking with Steve Ballard and Mike, I wasn't clear, and I didn't press it too hard whether or not that's in the scope. But
I'll find it.
Uh-huh. You know, those two men and women's restrooms are so hard because they're graffiti all the time.
The intent is when you go to the new area, that we're having problems with the floor that we'll probably have to replace. But when you go to the new area, is to continue that color theme and finishes throughout the rest of the area. So I'll check to make sure, because even if it's the old tile, there is a treatment that we've been using in some of the other areas.
Okay.
It seems to have been working pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this is a cleanliness issue or even a refurbishing.
Issue.
I think the ceramic finish on it is just gone.
Okay.
So there's 26
right.
years
we'll
old.
We'll check the three bathrooms in the ED.
Yep. Thanks, Carol, for reminding me of that.
Karen, do you have any questions?
And if it's not in scope, then I certainly can see about having that done
right.
And some treatment
sure.
used.
It's just
the East
so
Tower
stark.
Bathrooms were of the same product, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And this Sani something or other, Sani Glaze Clean, and you might know what it is, but it seems to have worked well because we redid the showers. It was the showers that had that tile in those rooms.
Okay. Any other comments about the inspection? And we haven't scheduled the fourth quarter yet, have we?
We have not, and so I always look to Andrea for her assistance working with the hospital to schedule the next quarter.
Okay. Maybe we could go ahead and schedule both the next quarter and maybe the first quarter of the new year so that they're on the calendars. Okay.
I had one more question. The foam stuff, you know, in the helicopter pad, and that gets emptied once a year, maybe people should be notified so that they don't think that it's snowing outside.
I mean, I've observed it before, and as I mentioned, when we were up on the helipad, it is quite spectacular to see the those foam. But you wouldn't be confused of snowing from the air. It's it's contained right onto where the helicopter would be.
Oh, they were saying that you could see it from. You can see it from here.
You can, but
does it go onto the ground?
Yeah.
No, it it all goes up to where the helicopter sits, and there's drains that it drains back into the collection units on the mechanical penthouse floor right below.
I was just thinking
that. Doesn't it drain out onto the, kind of in the front where you go into the front entry? I remember seeing one time like a whole bunch that looked like a snow drift there one time.
Yeah, I heard you say about the snow drift, but I'm just saying to let people be aware of it, because, you know, they'll think something's wrong.
I would defer to you a little bit.
I don't even know. Wow.
It's the foam deluge system on the helipad, right. So should there be an incident, God forbid, where the helicopter catches on fire, activated,
right.
But once a year, without a helicopter there, it is tested.
Oh. And they empty it, and they say it's just a big mass of white foam.
For the annual testing.
Yeah.
Usually, Steve discusses items like that at our safety huddles.
Oh, okay.
So whenever he's going to do a testing that's going to make people wonder, like right now we've got the big crane, he'll always inform in the daily safety huddle what's going on so that there can be communication to the staff.
Okay.
So at least the employees should know when we're testing those types of, you know, those types of systems.
Okay. I'll let the weather service know. Mm-hmm. It was a joke. Let the weather service know.
Yeah.
All right.
Foam wrapping.
Scent is coming.
The next item, and I have to take a phone call. The next item is we wanted a little update as to how Senate Bill 1152 is being implemented. I don't know if we sort of know what's going on at JFK and Desert, but we don't know what's going on at the other hospitals, and then sort of what's going on in Rivers Inland Empire, and is it being implemented, and what are the barriers and stuff. We want to kind of an update on that.
Sure.
And I'm sorry, I have to.
I can give you the keyboard you can use, or you can scroll with the mouse. Down. Or you can use this if you want.
Okay.
Alright. So, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about our homeless initiatives. So, as we know, there was a bill recently passed. It was SB 1152. Part of it went into effect in January of 2019. SB 1152 was a pretty robust bill that was put up by Senator Hernandez out of Los Angeles, and it was to help them determine ways to address homelessness, and it really focused on how hospitals can impact homelessness. So we felt like it was a little misguided. Although it did highlight a lot of things that we were already doing within the healthcare system. The requirements, we had to have this certain components in place in January, and then on July 1st, we had to have several other components in place. The July 1st requirements were the homeless log. So your institution, and just like everyone else in California, had to have a homeless log that identified homeless individuals, had to have three main requirements. One was it had to identify them, it had to be a unique identifier, and it had to indicate that you had completed the remainder of the homeless discharge requirements. So a person, the one big challenge that we had in California was no one could really identify who a homeless person was. Everybody had their own definition. HUD has a definition, hospitals had a definition, the state had a definition. So this bill came up with a solid definition that everyone goes by, and it's lack of a fixed or regular nighttime residence, or a primary nighttime residence that has supervised public or private shelter, or is residing in a location that's not designated to provide temporary living accommodations or be used as sleep accommodations for human beings. So that's now our common goal, is to identify those individuals, and we mark them as homeless. So the requirements that came into place, and these were, except for the log, these were required to be in place by January 1st. You had to have a redefined purpose statement. All hospitals have a patient discharge policy in place. This added the caveat to it that you had to have a sub component of that policy now that addressed homelessness, and it had to be clearly documented in your discharge policy. You had to ask the patient about their homeless status and document their answer. So they can say I'm homeless or not. They don't have to identify they're homeless. You have to ask them, and you have to document what their response was. You have to have a non-discriminatory clause in your policy saying that you don't discriminate on race, gender, housing status, financial status, etc. You had to have an individual discharge plan in place. And most hospitals, like I said, already have a discharge plan. You just had to incorporate that homeless piece into it. And you had to identify post-discharge locations or destinations in your community. And you had to have your log in place by the 1st of July.
May I ask a question about identifying the post-discharge? So if somebody's homeless and you're going to discharge them and you call Coachella Valley Rescue Mission, do you need the acceptance of that place, or you're just saying we're going to take you there?
You have to have the acceptance. So you have to have there's a couple of pieces to that. So and that's a very common question. So you have to ask them. You have to ask the individual when you are in the discharge planning portion is, do you want to go? You meet the requirements to go here. Coachella Valley Rescue Mission is a great place for this particular part of the geography of Riverside. So do you want to go there? And they can say yes or no. And if they say yes, then you have to call the mission. You have to say, I'm going to send Kevin Porter over to your place. And you have to document their name, the person that you spoke to, and that they've accepted Kevin Porter into the rescue. So and then that has to be documented into the log. And that's part of the requirements of having the log.
What happened in the case that person has a psychosis, for example?
They have a psychosis?
A psychosis, exactly.
So,
dementia.
That's a problem for a lot of hospitals, in that you cannot find a location easily for them unless you place them in a specific SNF or board care that takes those individuals. Once again, they can, unless you deem them to be incompetent or unable to care for themselves. And you can say, do you want to go to this place? And they can say no. you can discharge them. You have to do your due diligence to try to find them a place. Due diligence is not spend 10 hours working on finding them a location. It's a reasonable amount of time, and you can discharge them from your facility.
But I think in this case, their judgment would be a legal determination. Who determines whether if their judgment is okay? I think clinically,
your physician, your medical team, will have to have that determination. So if you believe them to have a neurologic condition, then you have to have them evaluated for that.
So it,
or a behavioral health.
We can't stop them from leaving unless they meet the definition and have been put on a 5150 hold. We can't stop them from leaving.
But you could put them on a 5150 if you thought they needed to.
We have providers who could assess and put them on a 5150 if they felt they needed them. But then because we're not an acute psych facility, you know, that doesn't last for very long.
Yeah.
Well, you can't determine that either.
Ultimately, the individual does end up being able to get up and leave.
So the concern that I'm raising is not related directly to the RMC. It is a concern that many of our community partners are raising to us, that there are cases of patients that are being discharged that they shouldn't be discharged, or in the case of what I'm listening is there is a criteria that has to be met, and it seems that it ends up being the discretion of whoever is doing that discharge, and they're releasing patients that have some conditions that makes them incapable of making a sound decision, and then they're dropped at a place that never agreed in the first place to receive that patient, and it might be because somebody asked a patient that wasn't capable of providing a coherent answer to say, do you want to go to Coachella Valley Rescue Mission? And they would say, oh yes. And then they appear at Coachella Valley Rescue Mission without the consent of the site, and the site not being prepared to receive such patients because they come with many other complications. And in a case very specific that we heard very recently, patients that come in a wheelchair to a facility that didn't have the conditions to accept the patient. So, and it's not the RMC, but it's another hospital that it's within the region.
I was going to say, if it is DRMC, we'd be happy to.
Well, so there's there's a lot of these issues, and I've heard this at other hospitals. I've been around and I've talked to several of the shelters, and we're trying to work out how those work. And there's three sides to every story. There's my side, your side, and somewhere in the middle there's the truth of what happened. So, and that's kind of how I go forward. So when I get the hospitals together and I get the shelters together and we talk about some of these discharges that happened, sometimes you ask the hospital discharged them and the patient wanted to leave and wanted to go there, and the patient went there. You cannot keep the patient unless they meet criteria. They're danger to themselves, danger to others, or gravely disabled. And your definition of gravely disabled is, can they take care of them? Are they able to provide their ADLs? And so, unless they meet those criteria, you can't keep them. You can send them out. It depends on who you speak to at the mission. So recently, not to bury anybody, but so I was at Path of Life Ministries, and they were having the same complaint. A patient showed up with his wheelchair, and they're not able to take patients in that have wheelchairs or disabilities. So backtracking to find out where that person came from, the person wasn't sent by the hospital. The person self-selected to go there. The hospital is required to provide them transportation 30 minutes to 30 miles from your facility. That's part of this bill. So they put the person in the Uber and say, send them here, or the taxi, send them here. And the guy in the car says, no, I want to redirect, I want to go here, and the guy takes them. So some of that you got to sit down and really figure out, talk to the hospital that did it, talk to the people that were involved, and try to figure out what really happened. And some of that's inappropriate. And we need to have a conversation with the facilities about what's inappropriate and what's appropriate, and make sure that we highlight what those restrictions are, criteria are for going into Path of Life Ministry, since I was out there talking to them. And we're working with the hospitals now to work that out. Some of the challenges that the hospitals have, and I'm sure it's consistent with here, is that there's not a lot of shelter space to go to, and there's not a lot of space in our communities that meet the needs of the patients that we're trying to discharge. So we have somebody with mild to moderate mental health conditions that, for whatever reason, they're excluded from going to a shelter. So where do you do them? Where do you send them? They don't want to be discharged. They want to stay in your hospital. How long can you keep them in a hospital? I spoke to one hospital recently. The longest person that they've had in their hospital was over 280 days, trying to find a placement for them. So, you know, we can't keep these people in our institutions for 280 days. So we have to find something that's reasonable. So we have to stand up recuperative care. We have to stand up low barrier shelters. We have to work together to kind of solve some of these problems. This particular piece of legislation, and that's where it was kind of ill thought out. So you have an emergency department that's overcrowded, overutilized, underfunded, taking care of patients that it can't move through the system. And we're getting pressure from our EMS folks. So ambulance patient offload delays. That's a big issue in Riverside County and in San Bernardino County. So that means an ambulance is sitting on your wall instead of in the community responding to emergencies in your community. So every bed that we keep somebody in longer than, you know, 2 or 3 hours, that's a bed that could have been used for somebody else that's sitting in your waiting room or sitting on an ambulance in your wall. So we have to figure out how do we improve throughput, how do we get these people out, where do we send them. Post-acute care is a big area that we need to start addressing, and it's not just for homeless. This is the platform I came to talk on, but it's behavioral health. We have a rising population of elderly people that have dementia, some sort of dementia, or have food insecurity or housing insecurity that we need to find help for. So there's all these post-acute care things that we need to start looking on, and that's part of that continuum. That's the downstream effect of not having enough resources in our community. Some of the upstream, you know, we talk about upstream things too to impact that. But this particular piece of legislation made it more onerous for hospitals to discharge folks back into our community. It does not take away the individual's right to say no. And it has a lot of, you have to go through a lot of steps to deem someone incompetent in the emergency department. The emergency department's in an acute care setting. You walk into emergency department to have your emergency identified, and then it should be referred to a specialist, right? You go in the emergency department with a stroke, you see a neurologist or a neurosurgeon. You go in with an MI, you see a cardiologist. You go in with a broken bone, you see an orthopod. You go into most emergency departments with a mental health crisis, and you wait to see a psychiatrist. So our ED docs are not specialists in everything. They're everything specialist, right? So they triage, they identify, and they move these patients back to where they belong. And some of these patients, it's hard. It's really, really difficult, and especially when you start talking about behavioral health. That's another hard thing to get our hands around, the difference between someone with a severe mental health condition and dementia, especially in the elderly. You may not have the whole picture looking at them as they walk into your ED unless they're a frequent flyer to your emergency department, you know their history. So that's something else we're working on with HIE, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit.
All right, sure.
Yeah, I don't dance well either. But so I'm not sure that answered your question, so I apologize. I'm not sure that answered your question, but it's kind of I'm not sure there is an answer to your question.
I know. I
would say generally there's very few individuals that the ER puts on a 5150. Usually they come in 5150.
And there is an opportunity for us to talk about behavioral health, and it's a big, I'm doing a lot of things in both counties around expanding the scope for behavioral health for these patients in our EDs. So some of the other requirements.
Next month, we'll talk about that.
Oh, okay, good. thank you, Michelle. So some of the other things that we have to do is, and that's part of the equation here, is that we have to, as under the EMTALA requirements, you have to provide them with a medical screening exam and rule out a medical emergency. So that's been in effect for a long time. We do that anyway. Most hospitals have a provider either in their triage or close to their triage to help identify those population of patients that can be easily managed and the ones that take longer to manage. They have to be referred for follow-up care, so either medical or behavioral health. And we can talk about some things that we've done for that around that already. They have to be provided with a meal. They have to be provided with weather-appropriate clothing. They have to be given 72 hours of discharge medication. So that one's a little confusing. You don't have to physically hand them the medication if you have a discharge pharmacy. You can hand them a prescription and tell them to go to the pharmacy.
What if you don't have a discharge pharmacy?
You can give them a prescription and send them to CVS down the street.
And how are they supposed to get there?
Uber, Lyft.
Is that something the hospital pays for as they're discharging them 30 miles out?
It depends on what your requirements are. You can give them a bus pass or I don't know how far your pharmacy is if you have a discharge pharmacy from here, but you do have a requirement to make sure they get those meds. So most hospitals that don't have a discharge pharmacy, they call whether their local pharmacy is, whether it's CVS or Rite Aid, and they get a contract with that facility to provide those medications.
And I understand that DRMC does not have a discharge pharmacy.
We do not. We have a pharmacy over in the El Mirador that's a retail pharmacy.
But that's not open at night.
That's not open at night.
Right.
So you're saying something that I would probably want some clarification on. My understanding is that you're obligated to provide a prescription for the meds.
Either the meds or a prescription.
A prescription for the meds, but not the actual meds, because we're not a retail pharmacy.
Not the actual
meds.
We
can't dispense.
Right. You have to give them a prescription.
So I think that's the confusion, because the question's been asked here: do we give individuals the actual medication? We do not. We give them a prescription for the medication.
Yeah, you don't want to be dispensing medicines out of your emergency department.
Right.
That has its own problems behind
so
it.
I want to be clear when he says you give them meds. You give them the script to get the meds.
Yeah.
And is it free, or do they pay for it?
It's not free. And you have to work that out between the health plan and your hospital. Who's going to pay for that?
And if they're uninsured?
Then the hospital will pay for that, probably.
No.
No.
It's complicated. You have post-discharge obligation to pay for the meds. But you do.
You have to provide them with the medication, with the 72 hours of medication. So.
Whether, if they're uninsured.
A prescription, right. Typically, what hospitals have done is they've, in other hospitals in other areas that are similar to yours, they'll call CVS and they'll work out where CVS will absorb the cost.
Right.
For that.
Target does like a low.
So, yeah, a low or no cost. Or, and we're seeing more and more of these individuals that are covered by a plan, a health plan. Part of the requirement of this bill is to make sure that you assess them for eligibility for a plan. So if they're not covered, you need to work at getting them covered if you can. There's some of these people that don't carry identification around with them. So you can't get them insured if they don't have identification.
Right.
So there are. So you're going to find these people that don't. But it's working out. So as far as the medication goes, it's working out that detail with your pharmacy, whoever you're referring people to.
What do we use here, Michelle?
You know, I'm texting Chris Langenwalter right now,
okay,
to ask her for clarification on it.
Well, so when we give them a prescription, do we tell them where to go to get it? Because we have a contract, or you have a contract with them, or some kind
of
arrangement?
Well, that's why I'm asking for some clarification.
Okay.
I'm not really sure of the answer of where they're sent to. I know during open hours we use the El Mirador. It's the after hours. I'm not sure.
And an uninsured person at El Mirador will get it 72 hours, but they pay for it?
Well, that's where the Fetzer Healthcare District Foundation's Social Services Fund comes in and helps offset that cost.
And is that comes out of the volunteer?
The auxiliary.
Auxiliary will pay for it.
We allocate $6,000
right.
a quarter, and then they can use that for post-discharge medication,
mm-hmm.
sometimes wheelchairs, sometimes canes,
mm-hmm. But if it's
a voucher, gas voucher.
If it's night at night, how does that work?
I don't know how it works at night, but I know you get from the Oakley Pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
They're not licensed to dispense in the hospital.
Oh, I know that. I'm talking about CVS or how that works. A patient gets discharged at night. They get a prescription, they go to CVS, but they're uninsured, they have no money.
That I know in the past, Desert's paid for that. Because we have not had
so that'd be interesting to see that.
And we have. That's, I just want to make sure the consistency of when the policy is applicable.
Yeah.
I'm not giving you bad or inconsistent information. Because I answered your question a while ago.
Right.
About the dispensing, where I said, no, we do not dispense,
do
we just give a script out of the ED. I don't recall if the conversation was specific to a homeless person. I think it was not. I think it was somebody who actually was insured, but had transportation challenges, and they were concerned about, okay, where do I go, and how do I access the after hours?
Mm-hmm.
The after hours, various after hours pharmacies, which there's actually quite a few of them.
Are there 24-hour pharmacies?
Yeah, quite a few.
Oh, yeah.
There should be. There's, I know in my neck of the woods.
Is that a pharmacy?
There are pharmacies that are
that's
they're
right.
not,
they're able or
they're not open.
So,
honestly, a lot of times we load them up before they leave. So, you know, when you can.
Right. So on top of the medication, you have to screen them. You have to provide them screening for infectious diseases. And the bill indicated that you have to screen them for infectious diseases that are common in your area. So, and that was a big question from a lot of the hospitals. Well, what diseases are common to my area? So we went back to the public health departments in both counties and had them issue us a letter. What diseases are common in our area that we need to screen for? And we've sent that out to all of the hospitals to include in their policies. And that letter will get updated annually from the public health department. You know, like in a good example would be in San Diego County, where they had the hepatitis A outbreak,
mm-hmm.
and they have tuberculosis, and they have several other diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure that we're staying current with that on an annual basis. It doesn't provide you to screen them. It says that you have to refer, that you have to screen them or refer them for screening. And so, along with that letter from the public health department, we had them include the locations of the areas that they can be referred to, the clinics they can be referred to for screening. The transportation piece we talked about, it's 30 minutes or 30 miles.
Just get vaccinations.
Vaccinations is the same with the screenings. A lot of the vaccinations, you can refer them to a public entity for free vaccinations. And so we got that included with the public health department.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to get a copy of
yes.
that?
Yes.
To sure. see that? Mm-hmm.
We can send that over. Who would I send that to?
Order.
Yeah.
Send it to the...
I sent it to Michelle.
Yeah, we have it, but you can resend it.
Okay. All right. Excellent.
You're looking for the letter that says, okay, here's
what
the prevalence is.
We for. I'm just be nosy.
Yeah. And then...
I'd like to see that, too.
Yeah, why don't you send it to the office here so we can include it as an attachment to the minutes?
Okay.
You can send it to me.
Okay, yeah. And then the transportation piece, 30 minutes or 30 miles. You know, it's interesting, IEHP, prior to this piece of legislation going out, IEHP was mandated to start providing non-emergency transportation to folks. So clinic appointments, go to the pharmacy, that kind of stuff. So that's our health plan in the Inland Empire. And they immediately started racking up about $10 million a month in transportation costs.
Ooh.
So they've started to look at that and scale that back a little bit about what kind of transportation they were using. They were using Uber and Lyft and helping people get around. And so now they have a transportation hub. That particular hub allows for transportation to be arranged for individuals, but it's 3 to 5 days prior to their appointment. So we're working with them now to arrange or support you in providing more timely transportation of these individuals that's covered by IEHP or the health plan. Molina would be the other health plan. So we're working on that. I've been told that they will cover those costs for an IEHP member. Or a Molina will cover it for a Molina. And then the last on this particular slide is that you have to screen them and enroll them in an affordable coverage, if any, if possible, to make sure that they are covered individuals.
But if they don't have ID?
You can't. You can't enroll them.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the limitations, and I don't think there's any real way to get around that currently. There are mechanisms, and you can work with IEHP to try to find out who they are to get an identification for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't hold the
word. I know that Martha's Village has social workers at the cooling center down the street here that they help people get ID.
Well, keep in mind, too, we have in the emergency room 24/7
yeah.
eligibility workers for being able to assist people.
The problem is when somebody's undocumented, then they're not eligible for
mm-hmm.
anything.
Yep.
Well, and they need a driver's license, and DMV is still closed up the street.
No, it's open.
It's open.
Is it open?
It's
oh,
open
good. Good, I can go get my license renewed.
So part of the identification piece, and this is... when you asked earlier about what information do you need when you're discharging someone, it's you need to document the name of the person who agreed to accept the patient. You must send written or electronic information about the post-discharge health and behavioral needs of the patient, and discharge to the principal dwelling place or alternative destination as indicated by the patient. So these are things that you need to provide the patient or the recipient of the patient when they're being discharged from your ED. So out-of-county transfers, they're still not, you're not allowed to move people out of the county. So in 2008, it was illegal for hospitals to cause the cause of a transfer of a homeless patient to another county for the purpose of receiving supportive services. So if they're not from Los Angeles, you can't really discharge them to Los Angeles. That's kind of what this is saying.
But a homeless doesn't have an person doesn't have an address.
So, but, well, wherever they say they live.
Okay.
So if they say, I live on Figueroa Street in Los Angeles, then that's their home. That's where their home is, and you can send them there. But if they say they're from right here, you can't send them to Los Angeles. So, and you know, that was one of the pieces of this bill was, the home is wherever they say it is.
Mm-hmm.
Let me rephrase that. Their residence is wherever they say it is, because they're homeless, so their residence is wherever they say it is.
I followed a patient from the free clinic to the ED here, and his residence was behind CVS parking lot.
Yeah. There are several of the hospitals. I have a quarterly meeting where we meet with the hospitals to discuss these topics, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of them, you know, it's the corner of, or the bridge
yeah.
of, or
yeah.
the park here, or
mm-hmm.
They winter in Riverside and summer in San Bernardino, or vice versa. So the written plan of care, you need to coordinate with these services for your homeless people, and it's County Behavioral Health Department, County healthcare and social services, other healthcare providers, nonprofit organizations. You need to know their hours of operations, their admission procedures and requirements, population served, general scope of medical or behavioral services available, contact or intake coordinator, their hospital referral procedures and hospital training protocols for discharge staff. So, and these requirements are, the hospital is required to, let's see what the next slide is. So the hospital is required under those particular items to maintain a current list of community benefit organizations and validate that they're correct. So you can imagine that's a very timely endeavor and very costly for a hospital to sit down and start calling all the numbers in their referral list. You know, is this shelter open? Is that community benefit service open? Is that one open? What do they do? How do they work?
Has it changed?
So, and you know,
maintaining it is more of a challenge.
Yeah. So my years of experience as an ED director, I've learned that those numbers change on a regular basis. You know, this one will go out of business, but the same guy that ran it will open up this under a new name with a new number, and it becomes very arduous to keep track of. And the discharge planners would have a notebook with pages and pages and pages and stuff whited out and you know, lined out and stuff added.
So we've got an answer for you. So we love CB Hip and Play.
I have an answer for you too.
It's
so
with
that
IE Connect.
IE Connect. So
which
that,
we're on the umbrella of that.
And that's what I was going to mention.
Oh,
so right. So we have been working with our with IEHP and the who started the Aunt Bertha product several years ago. And it's called connectie.org. Connectie.org is a amalgamation of the coordinated entry systems and the 211 system in both counties. And it's becoming more robust as we go. We've been promoting it at all of our hospitals to include it in their policy and procedure plans as their coordination of care database. It lists all this information, and the 211 operators validate the services that are in it. We're asking people, the coordinated, the community benefit organizations, to go into the ConnectIE product and look up their service and then own it. There's a place where you can sign in and you can own that particular service, and it makes sure that it's valid and up to date, and it allows you to redirect your services of your discharge planners to do more important
CEOs
things.
CEOs can go in periodically
yes.
and update it all.
Yeah, so I really enjoy that product. I'm talking to a lot of the hospitals about or encouraging them to use it and to include it in their discharge planning.
Can I give you Alejandro's phone number who does our CB Hip training?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll give you a little card.
Yeah.
Or they have a card.
Yeah.
Or CB Hip. Yeah.
We're doing the, on the 33rd, they're putting on a Moving the Needle conference.
Yeah, that's on the
29th. You need to move because there is another meeting in this room in
all right.
hours.
Yeah, we're almost done here.
Well, go back to the last thing I didn't read it.
Okay, so these are some of the frequently asked questions. Can we send a patient to an in-county shelter without prior acceptance? If the patient identifies that shelter as his or her residence and the alternate destination if he wants, the answer is the law is unclear. If that's their residence, do you need authorization to send them? And we still don't have an answer for that particular question. The law does state that you can send them back to their residence, wherever their residence might be.
But I would think if a hospital ER discharge or hospital discharges somebody to a facility that at at the very least, they have to inform the facility that they're coming.
I agree. So, we do attempt to make those notifications. Some of these facilities, so pick a shelter. So you're discharging the person at 2 in the morning, you may not get an answer at 2 in the morning. So a lot of the shelters don't operate, or if you discharge somebody at 11 in the morning, some of these shelters like Path of Life Ministries, they don't open their administrative offices until 4 p.m. So if I'm Kevin Porter and I live at Path of Life Ministries and that's where I want to go, from 11 to 1, from 11 to 4, do I keep them in my ED so I can contact somebody? That's our question. The law does allow for us to discharge that patient in where it says that you're not required to spend an inordinate amount of time trying to discharge someone, an unreasonable amount of time. So it's not clear some of those scope issues. EDs work 24 hours a day, not everybody does. And that's, you know, it's pretty evident in this particular piece of legislation. This was the homeless stuff for 2017. ER visits versus inpatient visits. This was San Bernardino County. And you can see the number. This is between 2014 to 2017. And this came from SpeedTrack, by the way. Some of the things that we're still discussing are frequency of meals. So if you have somebody in your ED for, you know, 12 hours, do you have to feed them twice? It's a reasonable amount, and you know, the goodwill of, I think, our hospitals is we feed them at a reasonable periods of time. CMS proof of laundering. So one of the questions was, if you're required to provide them clothing appropriate for the weather, where do you get that clothing from? A lot of people are getting donations from their staff or from their local charities. The requirement is that laundered? You have a requirement in the hospital that your linen or things that are distributed to your patients have to be laundered at a certain temperature for a certain period of time. So we were kind of working through that. You get into the environment of care issues when you start handing out clothing to folks. We do have a line of clothing that we've worked at. It's a discount line of clothing called bobbarker.com. You can go in and it's a discount clothing line that we're through HASC for hospitals to acquire a standardized clothing set. And then the return visits for clothing and food, we've seen an uptick of patients that are returning to our emergency departments every 3 days, every 4 days, and they're looking for clothing or food. So what's your requirement to provide that? During the winter, one hospital said that they had a patient that would come in like every 4 days for a jacket. I need my jacket. I had it stolen. So every 4 days he'd have a jacket stolen, he'd come in. You know, they're not sure if it was stolen or if he's selling it, you know, for shoes. And so, you know, it's what's reasonable. The reasonableness of those particular things that you can document, this person's been here 9 times in you know, 14 days looking for a jacket. And you don't necessarily have to provide it if you think that they're abusing the system, but you have to document very well. Transportation, we do have a Go Butterfly vendor that we're using for, it provides a door-to-door transportation, door-through-door transportation for hospitals. So when you have that individual that has a dementia-type problem and you're trying to get them into a shelter that accepts them, you don't want to put them in a cab or a Uber and say, okay, go here, because Uber will let them out at the curb and they won't necessarily make it through the door. They may wander off. So this particular service does the door-through-door. The driver will actually escort them in, and they do have a van service for wheelchairs.
A lot of them are specific for disabled adults or people.
And then the data sharing piece. So we mentioned ConnectIE here. Manifest Medics, we've been working with Manifest Medics, ConnectIE, the homeless management information systems, and the coordinated entry systems to get a combined data set that gets a 360 of the patient. So we want to know where that patient came from, where they've been, what they've been given, where they've been referred to, did they accept those services, and then we want to know utilization. How many times has that person been in your ED? If they've been in your ED, one patient in Los Angeles, over a period of a year, they've been in an ED 1,000 times. So, you know, it's three So that's kind of overutilization. We're doing a pilot project right now at Riverside University Health Systems, and we're looking at the connectivity. We've sponsored a build and test of a system that pulls data out of their EMR into Manifest Medics and then provides for reporting of their patient populations. Once that's done, we'll know at the end of this month, we'll get the reportings out around the 30th, 1st of November, somewhere between the 30th of October and the 1st of November. And then we're going to go out and present that to the other hospitals in the Inland Empire for participation in a global program. Our goal is to set up a oversight group that looks at high utilizers and then can apply the intensive case management to those individuals, so we can catch the person that has dementia, mild dementia, that's being returned to the community, or the homeless person that's always in for services, or the, you know, whatever. So we're looking for those. And then the IEHIO is the referral service, and that's the Connect IU product. It's becoming more and more robust as we go.
Is Manifest Medics public?
Yes. And then once again, that's me and my assistant.
And we're on Manifest Medics. It's part of the IEHP contract requirement.
Yep. So, yeah, 99% of the hospitals in Riverside and San Bernardino County are on the platform. And the beauty of the platform is that it collects information on all patients, and we're now able to do analytics and retrieve some of that data. We've asked Manifest Medics to do a monthly report out of utilization of homeless patients. The one requirement and the one issue that we're going back to our hospitals are we need two things. We're developing a field at registration in the second address line where you can put in homeless so we can identify them at registration. And then on the new discharge codes, the ICD-10 discharge codes, there's a Z59 code that anyone can put in. It doesn't require a physician to do it, but your discharge coders can put in Z59, and that identifies that individual as a homeless also and allows us to go back and discharge. We understand that people's status can change during the course of their admission. So they may not tell the ED, but they may tell someone in the hospital.
You know, we put a code in the zip code field when we register.
A lot of people have been using Z code in the zip code
field.
So we're trying to get away from that because it's not consistently used. We're trying to get in something that can be consistent. We're looking at the address field of the second address bar, so we're adding a second address to the registration. Most of them have it. And in that line, we're asking people to put in HL, and then that can be picked up by Manifest Medics and converted into a homeless designation for registration. But that's something
but it hasn't happened
when, yet. When we finish this pilot at Riverside, we'll be out.
The data set.
Yep, yeah. Yep. We'll come out.
So, right now we're using the Z field.
Yep. So yeah, some folks are using either 999 or Z, so we need to get consistency.
Is it possible to get a copy of this research?
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a copy. Actually,
sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Any comments?
Very informative. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So you're going to provide the letter, the prevalence letter,
yep.
And then I need to check on our process for the 72-hour.
Right. Yep. And how they access the funding.
Karen, do you have any questions?
I want to sort of brainstorm for a second. I'm wondering if there might be a role for the healthcare district sort of combining the homeless and other issues, health issues, to convene a meeting sometime in the next year of the hospitals in the valley and the shelters in the valley, because I have no idea what happens. As you said, there's three opinions. There's, you know, the hospital issue, and then there's the shelter issue. It'd be nice to get people in the same room for the Coachella Valley to see, you know, get them to talk to each other and see how things are going. Include Eisenhower, maybe High Desert.
Yeah, because if we're not discharging, or if we have people that, I mean, I don't know. So I'm not sure what the other end of the receiving individuals are experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That
yeah.
So
might not be the right thing.
Yeah. We had the CDRM at our last program committee talked about their grant application. And They were talking about, the staff was there, about, and they didn't point the finger at Desert Regional, they pointed the finger at local hospitals about how patients were showing up in their hospital gowns with their IVs and
colostomy bags. Need to get them to talk to each other. We can facilitate that, but we can't necessarily do anything about it. So, I'm just, again, I'm throwing it out there to think about if we wanted to do something in the future, and I think that might be well received by everybody.
And I think part of the $10 million from Gavin Newsom for the city of Palm Springs is they're looking at also a respite care, developing a respite care facility for, just for that purpose for hospital discharge. But that's all part of facilities building, and that's
Right. But I'm talking about to have a forum where the hospitals and the shelters can talk to each other, and rather than rely on them to call each other and work out issues, we can bring them together. Anyway, just an idea. Any other issues? Thank you so much.
So you're welcome. The last thing is, I did want to bring this up, the Moving the Needle conference that's coming up. Please, if you haven't had a chance, take a look at it. It's a lot of great information from across the IE about what's happening with our community benefit partners. So, I'm presenting.
Nope. All right.
This is our area.
Oh, okay. Oh, no, I didn't know.
Is there any other new business or any comments before we adjourn?
Yeah. Good meeting. Thank you.
Okay. Next meeting.